be a relative of his own bird and felt sad that he should have caused this death. When he got home, the bird asked him whether he had brought good news from India. "No," said the merchant. "I fear that my news is bad. One of your relations collapsed and fell at my feet when I mentioned your captivity." As soon as these words were spoken, the merchant's bird collapsed and fell to the bottom of the cage. "The news of his kinsman's death has killed him too," thought the merchant. Sorrowfully, he picked up the bird and put it on the windowsill. At once the bird revived and flew to a nearby tree. "Now you know," the bird said, "that what you thought was disaster was in fact good news for me. And how the message, the suggestion of how to behave in order to free myself, was transmitted to me through you, my captor." And he flew away, free at last. From the Old Testament, 2 Samuel chapters 11 through 12. David and Bathsheba. At the turn of the year, when kings take the field, David sent Joab out with his other officers and all the Israelite forces, and they ravaged Ammon and laid siege to Rabbah, while David remained in Jerusalem. One evening David got up from his couch, and as he walked about on the roof of the palace, he saw from there a woman bathing, and she was very beautiful. He sent to inquire who she was, and the answer came, "It must be Bathsheba, daughter of Eliam, and wife of Uriah the Hittite." David wrote a letter to Joab and sent Uriah with it. He wrote in the letter, "Put Uriah opposite the enemy where the fighting is fiercest, and then fall back and leave him to meet his death." Joab stationed Uriah at a point where he knew they would put up a stout fight. The men of the city sallied out and engaged Joab, and some of David's guards fell. Uriah the Hittite was also killed. Joab sent David a dispatch with all the news of the battle. When Uriah's wife heard that her husband was dead, she mourned for him. And when the period of mourning was over, David sent for her and brought her into his house. She became his wife and bore him a son. The 27th Law. Play on people's need to believe to create a cult-like following. Judgment. People have an overwhelming desire to believe in something. Become the focal point of such desire by offering them a cause, a new faith to follow. Keep your words vague but full of promise. Emphasize enthusiasm over rationality and clear thinking. Give your new disciples rituals to perform. Ask them to make sacrifices on your behalf. In the absence of organized religion and grand causes, your new belief system will bring you untold power. The science of charlatanism, or how to create a cult in 5 easy steps. In searching, as you must, for the methods that will gain you the most power for the least effort, you will find the creation of a cult-like following one of the most effective. Having a large following opens up all sorts of possibilities for deception. Not only will your followers worship you, they will defend you from your enemies, and will voluntarily take on the work of enticing others to join your fledgling cult. This kind of power will lift you to another realm. You will no longer have to struggle or use subterfuge to enforce your will. You are adored and can do no wrong. You might think it a gargantuan task to create such a following, but in fact it's fairly simple. As humans, we have a desperate need to believe in something, anything. This makes us eminently gullible. We simply cannot endure long periods of doubt or of the emptiness that comes from a lack of something to believe in. Dangle in front of us some new cause, elixir, get-rich-quick scheme, or the latest technological trend or art movement, and we leap from the water as one to take the bait. Look at history. The chronicles of the new trends and cults that have made a mass following for themselves could fill the library. After a few centuries, a few decades, a few years, a few months, they generally look ridiculous, but at the time they seem so attractive, so transcendental, so divine. Always in a rush to believe in something, we will manufacture saints and faiths out of nothing. Do not let this gullibility go to waste. Make yourself the object of worship. Make people form a cult around you. The great European charlatans of the 16th and 17th centuries mastered the art of cult-making. They lived, as we do now, in a time of transformation. Organized religion was on the wane, science on the rise. People were desperate to rally around a new cause or faith. The charlatans had begun by peddling health elixirs and alchemic shortcuts to wealth. Moving quickly from town to town, they originally focused on small groups, until, by accident, they stumbled on a truth of human nature. The larger the group they gathered around themselves, the easier it was to deceive. The charlatan would station himself on a high wooden platform, hence the term mountebank, and the crowds would swarm around him. In a group setting, people were more emotional, less able to reason. Had the charlatan spoken to them individually, they might have found him ridiculous. But lost in a crowd, they got caught up in a communal mood of rapt attention. It became impossible for them to find the distance to be skeptical. Any deficiencies in the charlatan's ideas were hidden by the zeal of the mass. Passion and enthusiasm swept through the crowd like a contagion, and they reacted violently to anyone who dared to spread a seed of doubt. Both consciously studying this dynamic over decades of experiment and spontaneously adapting to these situations as they happened, the charlatans perfected the science of attracting and holding a crowd, molding the crowd into followers and the followers into a cult. The gimmicks of the charlatans may seem quaint today, but there are thousands of charlatans among us still, using the same tried-and-true methods their predecessors refined centuries ago, only changing the names of their elixirs and modernizing the look of their cults. We find these latter-day charlatans in all arenas of life, business, fashion, politics, art. Many of them, perhaps, are following in the charlatan tradition without having any knowledge of its history. But you can be more systematic and deliberate. Simply follow the five steps of cult-making that our charlatan ancestors perfected over the years. Step 1. Keep it vague. Keep it simple. To create a cult, you must first attract attention. This you should do not through actions, which are too clear and readable, but through words, which are hazy and deceptive. Your initial speeches, conversations, and interviews must include two elements. On the one hand, the promise of something great and transformative, and on the other, a total vagueness. This combination will stimulate all kinds of hazy dreams in your listeners, who will make their own connections and see what they want to see. To make your vagueness attractive, use words of great resonance, but cloudy meaning, words full of heat and enthusiasm. Fancy titles for simple things are helpful, as are the use of numbers and the creation of new words for vague concepts. All of these create the impression of specialized knowledge, giving you a veneer of profundity. By the same token, try to make the subject of your cult new and fresh, so that few will understand it. Done right, the combination of vague promises, cloudy but alluring concepts, and fiery enthusiasm will stir people's souls, and a group will form around you. Talk too vaguely, and you have no credibility. But it is far more dangerous to be specific. If you explain in detail the benefits people will gain by following your cult, you will be expected to satisfy them. As a corollary to its vagueness, your appeal should also be simple. Most people's problems have complex causes, deep-rooted neurosis, interconnected social factors, roots that go way back in time, and are exceedingly hard to unravel. Few, however, have the patience to deal with this. Most people want to hear that a simple solution will cure their problems. The ability to offer this kind of solution will give you great power and build you a following. Instead of the complicated explanations of real life, return to the primitive solutions of our ancestors, to good old country remedies, to mysterious panaceas. Step 2. Emphasize the visual and the sensual over the intellectual. Once people have begun to gather around you, two dangers will present themselves, boredom and skepticism. Boredom will make people go elsewhere. Skepticism will allow them the distance to think rationally about whatever it is you're offering, blowing away the mist you have artfully created and revealing your ideas for what they are. You need to amuse the bored, then, and ward off the cynics. The best way to do this is through theater or other devices of its kind. Surround yourself with luxury. Dazzle your followers with visual splendor. Fill their eyes with spectacle. Not only will this keep them from seeing the ridiculousness of your ideas, the holes in your belief system, it will also attract more attention, more followers. Appeal to all the senses. Use incense for scent, soothing music for hearing, colorful charts and graphs for the eye. You might even tickle the mind, perhaps by using new technological gadgets to give your cult a pseudo-scientific veneer, as long as you don't make anyone really think. Use the exotic, distant cultures, strange customs, to create theatrical effects, and to make the most banal and ordinary affairs seem signs of something extraordinary. Step 3. Borrow the forms of organized religion to structure the group. Your cult-like following is growing. It is time to organize it. Find a way both elevating and comforting. Organized religions have long held unquestioned authority for large numbers of people, and continue to do so in our supposedly secular age. And even if the religion itself has faded some, its forms still resonate with power. The lofty and holy associations of organized religion can be endlessly exploited. Create rituals for your followers. Organize them into a hierarchy, ranking them in grades of sanctity, and giving them names and titles that resound with religious overtones. Ask them for sacrifices that will fill your coffers and increase your power. To emphasize your gathering's quasi-religious nature, talk and act like a prophet. You are not a dictator, after all. You are a priest, a guru, a sage, a shaman, or any other word that hides your real power in the mist of religion. Step 4. Disguise your source of income. Your group has grown, and you have structured it in a church-like form. Your coffers are beginning to fill with your followers' money. Yet you must never be seen as hungry for money and the power it brings. It is at this moment that you must disguise the source of your income. Your followers want to believe that if they follow you, all sorts of good things will fall into their lap. By surrounding yourself with luxury, you become living proof of the soundness of your belief system. Never reveal that your wealth actually comes from your followers' pockets. Instead, make it seem to come from the truth of your methods. Followers will copy your each and every move in the belief that it will bring them the same results, and their imitative enthusiasm will blind them to the charlatan nature of your wealth. Step 5. Set up an us-versus-them dynamic. The group is now large and thriving, a magnet attracting more and more particles. If you're not careful, though, inertia will set in, and time and boredom will demagnetize the group. To keep your followers united, you must now do what all religions and belief systems have done. Create an us-versus-them dynamic. First, make sure your followers believe they are part of an exclusive club, unified by a bond of common goals. Then, to strengthen this bond, manufacture the notion of a devious enemy out to ruin you. There is a force of non-believers that will do anything to stop you. Any outsider who tries to reveal the charlatan nature of your belief system can now be described as a member of this devious force. If you have no enemies, invent one. Given a straw man to react against, your followers will tighten and cohere. They have your cause to believe in and infidels to destroy. Observances of the Law. Observance number 1. In the year 1653, a 27-year-old Milan man named Francesco Giuseppe Borri claimed to have had a vision. He went around town telling one and all that the Archangel Michael had appeared to him and announced that he had been chosen to be the Capitano Generale of the army of the new Pope, an army that would seize and revitalize the world. The Archangel had further revealed that Borri now had the power to see people's souls, and that he would soon discover the Philosopher's Stone, a long-sought-after substance that could change base metals into gold. Friends and acquaintances who heard Borri explain the vision, and who witnessed the change that had come over him, were impressed, for Borri had previously devoted himself to a life of wine, women, and gambling. Now he gave all that up, plunging himself into the study of alchemy, and talking only of mysticism and the occult. The transformation was so sudden and miraculous, and Bory's words were so filled with enthusiasm, that he began to create a following. Unfortunately, the Italian Inquisition began to notice him as well. They prosecuted anyone who delved into the occult. So he left Italy and began to wander Europe, from Austria to Holland, telling one and all that, "To those who follow me, all joy shall be granted." Wherever Bory stayed, he attracted followers. His method was simple. He spoke of his vision, which had grown more and more elaborate, and offered to look into the soul of anyone who believed him, and there were many. Seemingly in a trance, he would stare at this new follower for several minutes, then claim to have seen the person's soul, degree of enlightenment, and potential for spiritual greatness. If what he saw showed promise, he would add the person to his growing order of disciples, an honor indeed. The cult had 6 degrees, into which the disciples were assigned according to what Bory had glimpsed in their souls. With work and total devotion to the cult, they could graduate to a higher degree. Bory, whom they called His Excellency and Universal Doctor, demanded from them the strictest vows of poverty. All the goods and monies they possessed had to be turned over to him. But they didn't mind handing over their property, for Bory had told them, "I shall soon bring my chemical studies to a happy conclusion by the discovery of the Philosopher's Stone, and by this means we shall all have as much gold as we desire." Given his growing wealth, Bory began to change his style of living. Renting the most splendid apartment in the city, into which he had temporarily settled, he would furnish it with fabulous furniture and accessories, which he had begun to collect. He would drive through the city in a coach studded with jewels, with 6 magnificent black horses at its head. He never stayed too long in one place, and when he disappeared, saying he had more souls to gather into his flock, his reputation only grew in his absence. He became famous, although in fact he had never done a single concrete thing. From all over Europe, the blind, the crippled, and the desperate came to visit Bory, for word had spread that he had healing powers. He asked no fee for his services, which only made him seem more marvelous. And indeed some claimed that in this or that city he had performed a miracle cure. By only hinting at his accomplishments, he encouraged people's imaginations to blow them up to fantastic proportions. His wealth, for example, actually came from the vast sums he was collecting from his increasingly select group of rich disciples. Yet it was presumed that he had in fact perfected the Philosopher's Stone. The church continued to pursue him, denouncing him for heresy and witchcraft. And Bory's response to these charges was a dignified silence. This only enhanced his reputation and made his followers more passionate. Only the great are persecuted, after all. How many understood Jesus Christ in his own time? Bory didn't have to say a word. His followers now called the Pope the Antichrist. And so Bory's power grew and grew, until one day he left the city of Amsterdam, where he had settled for a while, absconding with huge sums of borrowed money and diamonds that had been entrusted to him. He claimed to be able to remove the flaws from diamonds through the power of his gifted mind. Now he was on the run. The Inquisition eventually caught up with him, and for the last 20 years of his life he was imprisoned in Rome. But so great was the belief in his occult powers that to his dying day he was visited by wealthy believers, including Queen Christina of Sweden. Supplying him with money and materials, these visitors allowed him to continue his search for the elusive Philosopher's Stone. Interpretation. Before he formed his cult, Bory seems to have stumbled on a critical discovery. Tiring of his life of debauchery, he decided to give it up and to devote himself to the occult, a genuine interest of his. He must have noticed, however, that when he alluded to a mystical experience, rather than physical exhaustion, as the source of his conversion, people of all classes wanted to hear more. Realizing the power he could gain by ascribing the change to something external and mysterious, he went further with his manufactured visions. The grander the vision, and the more sacrifices he asked for, the more appealing and believable his story seemed to become. Remember, people are not interested in the truth about change. They don't want to hear that it has to come from hard work or from anything as banal as exhaustion, boredom, or depression. They are dying to believe in something romantic, otherworldly. They want to hear of angels and out-of-body experiences. Indulge them. Hint of the mystical source of some personal change. Wrap it in ethereal colors, and a cult-like following will form around you. Adapt to people's needs. The Messiah must mirror the desires of his followers. And always aim high. The bigger and bolder your illusion, the better. Observance number 2. In the mid-1700s, word spread in Europe's fashionable society of a Swiss country doctor named Michael Schupach, who practiced a different kind of medicine. He used the healing powers of nature to perform miraculous cures. Soon well-to-do people from all over the continent, their ailments both serious and mild, were making the trek to the alpine village of Langnau, where Schupach lived and worked. Trudging through the mountains, these visitors witnessed the most dramatic natural landscapes that Europe has to offer. By the time they reached Langnau, they were already feeling transformed and on their way to health. Schupach, who had become known as simply the Mountain Doctor, had a small pharmacy in town. The place became quite a scene. Crowds of people from many different countries would cram the small room, its walls lined with colorful bottles filled with herbal cures. Where most doctors of the time prescribed foul-tasting concoctions that bore incomprehensible Latin names, as medicines often do still, Schupach's cures had names such as the Oil of Joy, Little Flower's Heart, or Against the Monster, and they tasted sweet and pleasing. Visitors to Langnau would have to wait patiently for a visit with the mountain doctor, because every day some 80 messengers would arrive at the pharmacy bearing flasks of urine from all over Europe. Schupach claimed he could diagnose what ailed you simply by looking at a sample of your urine and reading a written description of your ailment. Naturally, he read the description very carefully before prescribing a cure. When he finally had a spare minute, the urine samples took up much of his time, he would call the visitor into his office in the pharmacy. He would then examine this person's urine sample, explaining that its appearance would tell him everything he needed to know. Country people had a sense for these things, he would say. Their wisdom came from living a simple, godly life with none of the complications of urban living. This personal consultation would also include a discussion as to how one might bring one's soul more into harmony with nature. Schupach had devised many forms of treatment, each profoundly unlike the usual medical practices of the time. He was a believer, for instance, in electric shock therapy. To those who wondered whether this was in keeping with his belief in the healing power of nature, he would explain that electricity is a natural phenomenon. He was merely imitating the power of lightning. One of his patients claimed to be inhabited by 7 devils. The doctor cured him with electrical shocks, and as he administered these, he exclaimed that he could see the devils flying out of the man's body, one by one. Another man claimed to have swallowed a hay wagon and its driver, which were causing him massive pains in the chest. The mountain doctor listened patiently, claimed to be able to hear the crack of a whip in the man's belly, promised to cure him, and gave him a sedative and a purgative. The man fell asleep on a chair outside the pharmacy. As soon as he awoke, he vomited, and as he vomited, a hay wagon sped past him. The mountain doctor had hired it for the occasion, the crack of its whip making him feel that somehow he had indeed expelled it under the doctor's care. Over the years, the mountain doctor's fame grew. He was consulted by the powerful. Even the writer Goethe made the trek to his village. And he became the center of a cult of nature in which everything natural was considered worthy of worship. Schupach was careful to create effects that would entertain and inspire his patients. A professor who visited him once wrote, "One stands or sits in company. One plays cards, sometimes with a young woman. Now a concert is given, now a lunch or supper, and now a little ballet is presented. With a very happy effect, the freedom of nature is everywhere united with the pleasures of the beau monde. And if the doctor is not able to heal any diseases, he can at least cure hypochondria and the vapors." Interpretation. Schupach had begun his career as an ordinary village doctor. He would sometimes use in his practice some of the village remedies he had grown up with. And apparently he noticed some results, for soon these herbal tinctures and natural forms of healing became his specialty. And in fact, his natural form of healing did have profound psychological effects on his patients. Where the normal drugs of the time created fear and pain, Shupak's treatments were comfortable and soothing. The resulting improvements in his patients' mood was a critical element in the cures he brought about. The patients believed so deeply in his skills that they willed themselves into health. Instead of scoffing at their irrational explanations for their ailments, Shupak used their hypochondria to make it seem that he had effected a great cure. The case of the mountain doctor teaches us valuable lessons in the creation of a cult-like following. First, you must find a way to engage people's will, to make their belief in your powers strong enough that they imagine all sorts of benefits. Their belief will have a self-fulfilling quality, but you must make sure that it is you, rather than their own will, who is seen as the agent of transformation. Find the belief, cause, or fantasy that will make them believe with a passion, and they will imagine the rest, worshiping you as healer, prophet, genius, whatever you like. Second, Shupak teaches us the everlasting power of belief in nature and in simplicity. Nature, in reality, is full of much that is terrifying. Poisonous plants, fierce animals, sudden disasters, plagues. Belief in the healing, comforting quality of nature is really a constructed myth, a romanticism. But the appeal to nature can bring you great power, especially in complicated and stressful times. This appeal, however, must be handled right. Devise a kind of theater of nature in which you, as the director, pick and choose the qualities that fit the romanticism of the times. The mountain doctor played the part to perfection, playing up his homespun wisdom and wit, and staging his cures as dramatic pieces. He didn't make himself one with nature, instead he molded nature into a cult, an artificial construction. To create a natural effect, you actually have to work hard, making nature theatrical and delightfully pagan. Otherwise no one will notice. Nature, too, must follow trends and be progressive. Observance number 3. In 1788, at the age of 55, the doctor and scientist Franz Mesmer was at a crossroads. He was a pioneer in the study of animal magnetism, the belief that animals contain magnetic matter, and that a doctor or specialist can effect miraculous cures by working on this charged substance. But in Vienna, where he lived, his theories had met with scorn and ridicule from the medical establishment. In treating women for convulsions, Mesmer claimed to have worked a number of cures, his proudest achievement being the restoration of sight to a blind girl. But another doctor who examined the young girl said she was as blind as ever, an assessment with which she herself agreed. Mesmer countered that his enemies were out to slander him by winning her over to their side. This claim only elicited more ridicule. Clearly, the sober-minded Viennese were the wrong audience for his theories, and so he decided to move to Paris and start again. Renting a splendid apartment in his new city, Mesmer decorated it appropriately. Stained glass in most of the windows created a religious feeling, and mirrors on all the walls produced an hypnotic effect. The doctor advertised that in his apartment he would give demonstrations of the powers of animal magnetism, inviting the diseased and melancholic to feel its powers. Soon Parisians of all classes, but mostly women, who seemed more attracted to the idea than men did, were paying for entry to witness the miracles that Mesmer promised. Inside the apartment, the scents of orange blossom and exotic incense wafted through special vents. As the initiates filtered into the salon where the demonstrations took place, they heard harp music and the lulling sounds of a female vocalist coming from another room. In the center of the salon was a long oval container filled with water that Mesmer claimed had been magnetized. From holes in the container's metal lid protruded long, movable iron rods. The visitors were instructed to sit around the container, place these magnetized rods on the body part that gave them pains or problems, and then hold hands with their neighbors, sitting as close as possible to one another to help the magnetic force pass between their bodies. Sometimes, too, they were attached to each other by cords. Mesmer would leave the room, and assistant magnetizers, all handsome and strapping young men, would enter with jars of magnetized water that they would sprinkle on the patients, rubbing the healing fluid on their bodies, massaging it into their skin, moving them toward a trance-like state. and after a few minutes a kind of delirium would overcome the women. Some would sob, some would shriek and tear their hair, others would laugh hysterically. At the height of the delirium, Mesmer would re-enter the salon, dressed in a flowing silk robe embroidered with golden flowers, and carrying a white magnetic rod. Moving around the container, he would stroke and soothe the patients until calm was restored. Many women would later attribute the strange power he had on them to his piercing look, which they thought was exciting or quieting the magnetic fluids in their bodies. Within months of his arrival in Paris, Mesmer became the rage. His supporters included Marie Antoinette herself, the Queen of France, wife of Louis XVI. As in Vienna, he was condemned by the official faculty of medicine, but it did not matter. His growing following of pupils and patients paid him handsomely. Mesmer expanded his theories to proclaim that all humanity could be brought into harmony through the powers of magnetism, a concept with much appeal during the French Revolution. A cult of mesmerism spread across the country. In many towns, societies of harmony sprang up to experiment with magnetism. These societies eventually became notorious. They tended to be led by libertines, who would turn their sessions into a kind of group orgy. At the height of Mesmer's popularity, a French commission published a report based on years of testing the theory of animal magnetism. The conclusion? Magnetism's effects on the body actually came from a kind of group hysteria and auto-suggestion. The report was well documented and ruined Mesmer's reputation in France. He left the country and went into retirement. Only a few years later, however, imitators sprang up all over Europe, and the cult of mesmerism spread once again, its believers more numerous than ever. Interpretation. Mesmer's career can be broken into two parts. When still in Vienna, he clearly believed in the validity of his theory, and did all he could to prove it. But his growing frustration and the disapproval of his colleagues made him adopt another strategy. First he moved to Paris, where no one knew him, and where his extravagant theories found a more fruitful soil. Then he appealed to the French love of theater and spectacle, making his apartment into a kind of magical world in which a sensory overload of smells, sights, and sounds entranced his customers. Most important, from now on he practiced his magnetism only on a group. The group provided the setting in which the magnetism would have its proper effect, one believer infecting the other, overwhelming any individual doubter. Mesmer thus passed from being a confirmed advocate of magnetism to the role of a charlatan using every trick in the book to captivate the public. The biggest trick of all was to play on the repressed sexuality that bubbles under the surface of any group setting. In a group, a longing for social unity, a longing older than civilization, cries out to be awakened. This desire may be subsumed under a unifying cause, but beneath it is a repressed sexuality that the charlatan knows how to exploit and manipulate for his own purposes. This is the lesson that Mesmer teaches us. Our tendency to doubt, the distance that allows us to reason, is broken down when we join a group. The warmth and infectiousness of the group overwhelms the skeptical individual. This is the power you gain by creating a cult. Also, by playing on people's repressed sexuality, you lead them into mistaking their excited feelings for signs of your mystical strength. You gain untold power by working on people's unrealized desire for a kind of promiscuous and pagan unity. Remember, too, that the most effective cults mix religion with science. Take the latest technological trend or fad and blend it with a noble cause, a mystical faith, a new form of healing. People's interpretations of your hybrid cult will run rampant, and they will attribute powers to you that you had never even thought to claim. Reversal. One reason to create a following is that a group is often easier to deceive than an individual, and turns over to you that much more power. This comes, however, with a danger. If at any moment the group sees through you, you will find yourself facing not one deceived soul, but an angry crowd that will tear you to pieces as avidly as it once followed you. The charlatans constantly face this danger, and were always ready to move out of town, as it inevitably became clear that their elixirs did not work and their ideas were sham. Too slow, and they paid with their lives. In playing with the crowd, you are playing with fire, and must constantly keep an eye out for any sparks of doubt, any enemies who will turn the crowd against you. When you play with the emotions of a crowd, you have to know how to adapt, attuning yourself instantaneously to all of the moods and desires that a group will produce. Use spies, be on top of everything, and keep your bags packed. For this reason, you may often prefer to deal with people one by one. Isolating them from their normal milieu can have the same effect as putting them in a group. It makes them more prone to suggestion and intimidation. Choose the right sucker, and if he eventually sees through you, he may prove easier to escape than a crowd. Here are some further reflections on this law. From The Power of the Charlatan, by Greta De Francesco. It was to the charlatan's advantage that the individuals predisposed to credulity should multiply, that the groups of his adherents should enlarge to mass proportions, guaranteeing an even greater scope for his triumphs. And this was, in fact, to occur, as science was popularized from the Renaissance on down through succeeding centuries. With the immense growth of knowledge and its spread through printing in modern times, the mass of the half-educated, the eagerly gullible prey of the quack also increased, became indeed a majority. Real power could be based on their wishes, opinions, preferences, and rejections. The charlatan's empire, accordingly, widened with the modern dissemination of knowledge. Since he operated on the basis of science, however much he perverted it, producing gold with a technique borrowed from chemistry and his wonderful balsams with the apparatus of medicine, he could not appeal to an entirely ignorant folk. The illiterate would be protected against his absurdities by their healthy common sense. His choicest audience would be composed of the semi-literate, those who had exchanged their common sense for a little distorted information, and had encountered science and education at some time, though briefly and unsuccessfully. The great mass of mankind has always been predisposed to marvel at mysteries, and this was especially true at certain historic periods when the secure foundations of life seemed shaken, and old values, economic or spiritual, long accepted as certainties, could no longer be relied upon. Then the numbers of the charlatan's dupes multiplied. The self-killers, as a 17th-century Englishman called them. From the Thurber Chronicle, by James Thurber. The Owl Who Is God. Once upon a starless midnight, there was an owl who sat on the branch of an oak tree. Two ground moles tried to slip quietly by unnoticed. "You," said the owl. "Who?" they quavered in fear and astonishment, for they couldn't believe it was possible for anyone to see them in that thick darkness. "You too," said the owl. The moles hurried away and told the other creatures of the field and forest that the owl was the greatest and wisest of all animals because he could see in the dark, and because he could answer any question. "I'll see about that," said a secretary bird, and he called on the owl one night when it was again very dark. "How many claws am I holding up?" said the secretary bird. "Two," said the owl, and that was right. "Can you give me another expression for that is to say, or namely?" asked the secretary bird. "To wit," said the owl. "Why does a lover call on his love?" asked the secretary bird. "To woo," said the owl. The secretary bird hastened back to the other creatures and reported that the owl was indeed the greatest and wisest animal in the world, because he could see in the dark and because he could answer any question. "Can he see in the daytime, too?" asked a red fox. "Yes," echoed a dormouse and a French poodle. "Can he see in the daytime, too?" All the other creatures laughed loudly at this silly question, and they set upon the red fox and his friends and drove them out of the region. Then they sent a messenger to the owl and asked him to be their leader. When the owl appeared among the animals, it was high noon and the sun was shining brightly. He walked very slowly, which gave him an appearance of great dignity, and he peered about him with large, staring eyes. which gave him an air of tremendous importance. "He's God!" screamed a Plymouth Rock hen. And the others took up the cry. "He's God!" So they followed him wherever he went. And when he began to bump into things, they began to bump into things too. Finally, he came to a concrete highway, and he started up the middle of it, and all the other creatures followed him. Presently, a hawk, who was acting as outrider, observed a truck coming toward them at 50 miles an hour. And he reported to the secretary bird, and the secretary bird reported to the owl. "There's danger ahead," said the secretary bird. "To wit," said the owl. The secretary bird told him. "Aren't you afraid?" he asked. "Who?" said the owl calmly, for he could not see the truck. "He's God," cried all the creatures again, and they were still crying, "He's God," when the truck hit them and ran them down. Some of the animals were merely injured, but most of them, including the owl, were killed. Moral? You can fool too many of the people too much of the time. From Friedrich Nietzsche. To become the founder of a new religion, one must be psychologically infallible in one's knowledge of a certain average type of souls who have not yet recognized that they belong together. From Niccolo Machiavelli. Men are so simple of mind and so much dominated by their immediate needs that a deceitful man will always find plenty who are ready to be deceived. From The Power of the Charlatan, by Greta De Francesco. The Temple of Health. In the late 1780s, the Scottish quack James Graham was winning a large following and great riches in London. Graham maintained a show of great scientific technique. In 1772, he had visited Philadelphia, where he met Benjamin Franklin, and became interested in the latter's experiments with electricity. These appear to have inspired the apparatus in the Temple of Health, the fabulous establishment he opened in London for the sale of his elixirs. In the chief room, where he received patients, stood the largest air pump in the world, to assist him in his philosophical investigations into disease, and also a stupendous metallic conductor, a richly gilded pedestal surrounded with retorts and vials of ethereal and other essences. According to J. Ennemoser, who published a history of magic in 1844 at Leipzig, Graham's house united the useful with the pleasurable. Everywhere the utmost magnificence was displayed. Even in the outer court, averred an eyewitness, it seemed as though art, invention, and riches had been exhausted. On the side walls and the chambers, an arc-shaped glow was provided by artificial electric light. Star rays darted forth. Transparent glasses of all colors were placed with clever selection and much taste. All this, the same eyewitness assures us, was ravishing and exalted the imagination to the highest degree. Visitors were given printed sheets of rules for healthy living. In the great Apollo apartment, they might join in mysterious rituals, accompanied by chants. Hail, vital air, ethereal, magnetic magic, hail. And while they hailed the magic of magnetism, the windows were darkened, revealing a ceiling studded with electric stars and a young and lovely rosy goddess of health in a niche. Every evening this temple of health was crowded with guests. It had become the fashion to visit it and try the 12-foot bed of state, the grand celestial bed, said to cure any disease. This bed, according to Ennemoser, stood in a splendid room into which a cylinder led from an adjoining chamber to conduct the healing currents. At the same time, all sorts of pleasing scents of strengthening herbs and oriental incense were also brought in through glass tubes. The heavenly bed itself rested upon six solid transparent pillars. The bedclothes were of purple and sky-blue atlas silk, spread over a mattress saturated with Arabian-perfumed waters to suit the tastes of the Persian court. The chamber in which it was placed he called the Sanctum Sanctorum. To add to all this, there were the melodious notes of the harmonica, soft flutes, agreeable voices, and a great organ. From A Treasury of Jewish Folklore, The Power of a Lie. In the town of Tarnopol lived a man by the name of Reb Feivel. One day, as he sat in his house, deeply absorbed in his Talmud, he heard a loud noise outside. When he went to the window, he saw a lot of little pranksters. "Up to some new piece of mischief, no doubt," he thought. "Children, run quickly to the synagogue," he cried, leaning out and improvising the first story that occurred to him. "You'll see there a sea monster. And what a monster! It's a creature with 5 feet, 3 eyes, and a beard like that of a goat. Only it's green." And sure enough, the children scampered off, and Reb Feivel returned to his studies. He smiled into his beard as he thought of the trick he had played on those little rascals. It wasn't long before his studies were interrupted again, this time by running footsteps. When he went to the windows, he saw several Jews running. "Where are you running?" he called out. "To the synagogue," answered the Jews. "Haven't you heard? There's a sea monster. There's a creature with 5 legs, 3 eyes, and a beard like that of a goat, only it's green." Reb Feivel laughed with glee, thinking of the trick he had played, and sat down again to his Talmud. But no sooner had he begun to concentrate when suddenly he heard a dinning tumult outside. And what did he see? A great crowd of men, women, and children all running toward the synagogue. "What's up?" he cried, sticking his head out of the window. "What a question! Why, don't you know?" they answered. "Right in front of the synagogue there's a sea monster. It's a creature with 5 legs, 3 eyes, and a beard like that of a goat, only it's green." And as the crowd hurried by, Reb Feivel suddenly noticed that the rabbi himself was among them. "Lord of the world," he exclaimed. "If the rabbi himself is running with them, surely there must be something happening. Where there's smoke, there's fire." Without further thought, Reb Feivel grabbed his hat, left his house, and also began running. "Who can tell?" he muttered to himself as he ran, all out of breath, toward the synagogue.
The 28th Law. Enter action with boldness. Judgment. If you are unsure of a course of action, do not attempt it. Your doubts and hesitations will infect your execution. Timidity is dangerous. Better to enter with boldness. Any mistakes you commit through audacity are easily corrected with more audacity. Everyone admires the bold. No one honors the timid. Boldness and hesitation, a brief psychological comparison. Boldness and hesitation elicit very different psychological responses in their targets. Hesitation puts obstacles in your path. Boldness eliminates them. Once you understand this, you will find it essential to overcome your natural timidity and practice the art of audacity. The following are among the most pronounced psychological effects of boldness and timidity. The bolder the lie, the better. We all have weaknesses, and our efforts are never perfect. But entering action with boldness has the magical effect of hiding our deficiencies. Con artists know that the bolder the lie, the more convincing it becomes. The sheer audacity of the story makes it more credible, distracting attention from its inconsistencies. When putting together a con or entering any kind of negotiation, go further than you planned. Ask for the moon, and you will be surprised how often you get it. Lions circle the hesitant prey. People have a sixth sense for the weaknesses of others. If, in a first encounter, you demonstrate your willingness to compromise, back down, and retreat, you bring out the lion, even in people who are not necessarily bloodthirsty. Everything depends on perception. And once you are seen as the kind of person who quickly goes on the defensive, who is willing to negotiate and be amenable, you will be pushed around without mercy. Boldness strikes fear. Fear creates authority. The bold move makes you seem larger and more powerful than you are. If it comes suddenly, with the stealth and swiftness of a snake, it inspires that much more fear. By intimidating with a bold move, you establish a precedent. In every subsequent encounter, people will be on the defensive, in terror of your next strike. Going halfway with half a heart digs the deeper grave. If you enter an action with less than total confidence, you set up obstacles in your own path. When a problem arises, you will grow confused, seeing options where there are none, and inadvertently creating more problems still. Retreating from the hunter, the timid hare scurries more easily into his snares. Hesitation creates gaps. Boldness obliterates them. When you take time to think, to hem and haw, you create a gap that allows others time to think as well. Your timidity infects people with awkward energy, elicits embarrassment. Doubt springs up on all sides. Boldness destroys such gaps. The swiftness of the move and the energy of the action leaves others no space to doubt and worry. In seduction, hesitation is fatal. It makes your victim conscious of your intentions. The bold move crowns seduction with triumph. It leaves no time for reflection. Audacity separates you from the herd. Boldness gives you presence and makes you seem larger than life. The timid fade into the wallpaper. The bold draw attention. And what draws attention draws power. We cannot keep our eyes off the audacious. We cannot wait to see their next bold move. Observances of the law. Observance number one. In May of 1925, five of the most successful dealers in the French scrap metal business found themselves invited to an official but highly confidential meeting with a deputy director general of the Ministry of Post and Telegraphs at the Hotel Crillon, then the most luxurious hotel in Paris. When the businessmen arrived, it was the director general himself, a Monsieur Lustig, who met them in a swank suite on the top floor. The businessmen had no idea why they had been summoned to this meeting, and they were bursting with curiosity. After drinks, the director explained, "Gentlemen," he said, "this is an urgent matter that requires complete secrecy. The government is going to have to tear down the Eiffel Tower." The dealers listened in stunned silence as the director explained that the tower, as recently reported in the news, desperately needed repairs. It had originally been meant as a temporary structure for the exposition of 1889. Its maintenance costs had soared over the years, and now, in a time of fiscal crisis, the government would have to spend millions to fix it. Many Parisians considered the Eiffel Tower an eyesore and would be delighted to see it go. Over time, even the tourists would forget about it. It would live on in photographs and postcards. "Gentlemen," Lustig said, "you are all invited to make the government an offer for the Eiffel Tower." He gave the businessmen sheets of government stationery, filled with figures, such as the tonnage of the tower's metal. Their eyes popped as they calculated how much they could make from the scrap. Then Lustig led them to a waiting limo, which brought them to the Eiffel Tower. Flashing an official badge, he guided them through the area, spicing his tour with amusing anecdotes. At the end of the visit, he thanked them and asked them to have their offers delivered to his suite within 4 days. Several days after the offers were submitted, one of the five, a Monsieur P., received notice that his bid was the winner, and that to secure the sale, he should come to the suite at the hotel within 2 days, bearing a certified check for more than 250,000 francs, the equivalent today of about $1 million, a quarter of the total price. On delivery of the check, he would receive the documents confirming his ownership of the Eiffel Tower. Monsieur P. was excited. He would go down in history as the man who had bought and torn down the infamous landmark. But by the time he arrived at the suite, check in hand, he was beginning to have doubts about the whole affair. Why meet in a hotel instead of a government building? Why hadn't he heard from other officials? Was this a hoax, a scam? As he listened to Lustig discuss the arrangements for the scrapping of the tower, he hesitated and contemplated backing out. Suddenly, however, he realized that the director had changed his tone. Instead of talking about the tower, he was complaining about his low salary, about his wife's desire for a fur coat, about how galling it was to work hard and be unappreciated. It dawned on Monsieur P. that this high government official was asking for a bribe. The effect on him, though, was not outrage, but relief. Now he was sure that Lustig was for real, since in all of his previous encounters with French bureaucrats, they had inevitably asked for a little greasing of the palm. His confidence restored, Monsieur P. slipped the director several thousand francs in bills, then handed him the certified check.
In return, he received the documentation, including an impressive-looking bill of sale. He left the hotel, dreaming of the profits and fame to come. Over the next few days, however, as Monsieur P. waited for correspondence from the government, he began to realize that something was amiss. A few telephone calls made it clear that there was no Deputy Director General Lustig, and there were no plans to destroy the Eiffel Tower. He had been bilked of over 250,000 francs. Monsieur P. never went to the police. He knew what kind of reputation he would get if word got out that he had fallen for one of the most absurdly audacious cons in history. Besides the public humiliation, it would have been business suicide. Interpretation. Had Count Victor Lustig, con artist extraordinaire, tried to sell the Arc de Triomphe, a bridge over the Seine, a statue of Balzac, no one would have believed him. But the Eiffel Tower was just too large, too improbable to be part of a con job. In fact, it was so improbable that Lustig was able to return to Paris 6 months later and resell the Eiffel Tower to a different scrap iron dealer, and for a higher price. A sum in francs equivalent today to over $1,500,000. Largeness of scale deceives the human eye. It distracts and awes us, and is so self-evident that we cannot imagine there is any illusion or deception afoot. Arm yourself with bigness and boldness. Stretch your deceptions as far as they will go, and then go further. If you sense that the sucker has suspicions, do as the intrepid Lustig did. Instead of backing down or lowering his price, he simply raised his price higher by asking for and getting a bribe. Asking for more puts the other person on the defensive, cuts out the nibbling effect of compromise and doubt, and overwhelms with its boldness. Observance number 2. On his deathbed in 1533, Vasily III, the Grand Duke of Moscow and ruler of a semi-united Russia, proclaimed his 3-year-old son, Ivan IV, as his successor. He appointed his young wife, Helena, as regent until Ivan reached his majority and could rule on his own. The aristocracy, the boyars, secretly rejoiced. For years, the dukes of Moscow had been trying to extend their authority over the boyars' turf. With Vasily dead, his heir a mere 3 years old, and a young woman in charge of the dukedom, the boyars would be able to roll back the duke's gains, wrest control of the state, and humiliate the royal family. Aware of these dangers, young Helena turned to her trusted friend, Prince Ivan Obolensky, to help her rule. But after 5 years as regent, she suddenly died. Poisoned by a member of the Shuisky family, the most fearsome boyar clan. The Shuisky princes seized control of the government and threw Obolensky in prison, where he starved to death. At the age of 8, Ivan was now a despised orphan, and any boyar or family member who took an interest in him was immediately banished or killed. And so Ivan roamed the palace, hungry, ill-clothed, and often hiding from the Shuiskys, who treated him roughly when they saw him. On some days they would search him out, clothe him in royal robes, and hand him a scepter and set him on the throne, a kind of mock ritual in which they lampooned his royal pretensions. Then they would shoo him away. One evening, several of them chased the Metropolitan, the head of the Russian church, through the palace, and he sought refuge in Ivan's room. The boy watched in horror as the Shuiskys entered, hurled insults, and beat the Metropolitan mercilessly. Ivan had one friend in the palace, a boyar named Vorontsov, who consoled and advised him. One day, however, as he, Vorontsov, and the newest Metropolitan conferred in the palace refectory, several Shuiskys burst in, beat up Vorontsov, and insulted the Metropolitan by tearing and treading on his robes. Then they banished Vorontsov from Moscow. Throughout all this, Ivan maintained a strict silence. To the boyars it seemed that their plan had worked. The young man had turned into a terrified and obedient idiot. They could ignore him now, even leave him alone. But on the evening of December 29th, 1543, Ivan, now 13, asked Prince Andrei Shuisky to come to his room.
When the prince arrived, the room was filled with palace guards. Young Ivan then pointed his finger at Andrei and ordered the guards to arrest him, have him killed, and throw his body to the bloodhounds in the royal kennel.